The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
In the Dáil today, they are debating the Public Health Tobacco Amendment Bill 2024. This proposes to increase the minimum age of the purchase of tobacco products to 21. I think they've already got rid of vending machines. This will make Ireland the first country to do this. And it's expected that it will be coming into effect on the 1st of February 2028. Well, to debate whether this is a good idea, whether this is enforceable or not, we'll shortly speak to Professor John Crown, medical oncologist, one of the leading oncologists, both in terms of research and in terms of treatment, and of course a former senator. But first we're going to talk to Simon Clark, Director of Forest, voice and friend of the smoker. Simon, welcome to the programme. What's your reaction to this latest legislation?
Good morning. Well, I feel it is a bit of a political gimmick. We're having the same issue in the UK, where the government wants to go even further and introduce a generational ban where you'll be raising the age of sale by 1 year every year. Now, some would say that raising it from 18 to 21 is a reasonable compromise. But I would still argue that when you are 18, you're legally an adult and you should be treated like one. Now, at 18, you can drive a car, you can join the army, you can possess a credit card, you can purchase alcohol, and of course, you can vote. So if you can do all those things at the age of 18, we believe you should also be allowed to purchase cigarettes and other tobacco products.
Now, we know in relation to alcohol that publicans have found it very difficult in the hospitality sector to enforce this, because you could have one young fella who looks like a 24-year-old and he's actually 19 and so on. Do you think that it's going to be credible at retail level, if you go into a newsagent's, tobacconist, whatever, that you'd have to produce ID?
Well, I think it's going to be an issue for retailers, undoubtedly, because they are going to have to ask people for ID. Now, again, I don't know what retail crime is like in Ireland. In the UK, it's at record levels. And so clearly, if you prohibit something, you're going to put retailers at risk, because there will be people who, you know, quite wrongly, but they will not only want to break the law, they might want to use violence as well in order to get hold of cigarettes and other tobacco products. I think an important issue here, though, is that one of the reasons this is being introduced is because people are saying it's going to protect children. Now, we're talking about people under 18. But it's going to have absolutely no impact on under 18-year-olds, because there is already a law in place that bans the sale of tobacco to people under 18. So instead of targeting young adults, people who are aged 18, 19, 20, what the government should be doing is cracking down on anyone who sells tobacco to people who are under 18. That's the way we protect children, not targeting young adults. And targeting young adults and treating them like children, I think, is completely wrong. At the age of 18, people have to be allowed and encouraged to make decisions about their own lifestyles. And of course, the vast majority of children and young adults don't smoke these days anyway. Smoking rates continue to fall. And if you're not careful, you're actually going to make smoking tobacco fashionable again. You're going to actually encourage some younger people to smoke. Because imagine that university, for example, where you've got 18, 19, 20, and 21-year-olds all mixing together. The idea that, you know, you can stop smoking amongst that that cohort is complete nonsense.
One of the biggest deterrents of smoking is, of course, tax. Is a lot of the purchase of smoking and tobacco products actually in the black market now?
Well, it is. And you only have to read all the reports about the amount of smuggled tobacco that's coming into ports in Dublin and elsewhere to know that black market tobacco is a major problem. And as soon as you start to prohibit a substance, and we are talking here about creeping prohibition, well, inevitably, the only people who will be rubbing their hands are the criminal gangs, because they don't care about age limits. They don't care about the 18 age limit. The idea that they'll be bothered about who the age of the people they're selling cigarettes to is complete nonsense. And they are now going to have an even bigger market in future, because if tobacco is prohibited to 18, 19, 20-year-olds, That is a substantial market to the criminal gangs.
Finally, I mean, I smoked my last cigarette at 6:15 on the 6th of August, 1988, and I had asthma and I had other problems. I used to smoke avidly, 20 plus a day. Now that I'm 64, I can see that was the best decision I ever took. Surely it is a no-brainer that we need to do everything and anything on the public health side, given the number of deaths per year. And any measure should therefore be 4,500 deaths a year, I see calculated, from smoking. I mean, do you not accept the general point that this is the public good?
I don't, to be honest, because I do think it's very important that people should be educated about the health risks of smoking and also about the health risks of drinking alcohol to excess and the health risks of eating, you know, fatty foods and dairy products. All these things, the government has a role to play educating people about the health risks. But in a free and liberal society, there has to come a point where we allow people to make their own decisions. The government can't dictate how we live our lives to the nth degree. And you're not alone. I mean, there are many people who've given up smoking for the very same reasons that you described and haven't regretted it. But also, and we're not allowed to say this these days, there are still a great many people who know the health risks of smoking but continue to smoke because they enjoy it. They get pleasure from it or they get comfort from smoking. All these things are perfectly legitimate. And as I say, in a free and generally liberal society, you have to accept that some people have the right to make what you might call the wrong decisions. That's their choice and it must be respected.
Simon Clark, Director of Forest, thank you for joining us. Professor John Crown, good morning and thank you for joining us. I know how busy you are. Are you in favour of this?
Good morning, Ivan. Yeah, I am, Ivan. I mean, I'm not internally programmed to ever oppose any anti-smoking legislation. I think as you pointed out, the clear-cut public health benefits for decreasing smoking completely overwhelm any of the other arguments which are made in opposition to this law. So I would be supportive of it. I must say, though, I do think we've probably nearly maxed out on how we can tackle smoking by limiting the behaviours of smokers. I do think we need to be much more aggressive in going after the industry. And that's why I personally think we should be aiming for a model that, give them plenty of notice, maybe 10, 12 years, say it will no longer be legal to manufacture cigarettes, to grow and sell tobacco, to do any kind of commerce in tobacco. That will no longer be a legal activity because, honestly, this is a product that was the ultimate grandfather product. I mean, if we discovered smoking tomorrow, it would never be legal. Like, you know, we ban chemicals because they're present in paint strippers, which you don't drink, but in case you may be exposed to the fumes of it. But we don't ban something which people put directly into their bodies, which, if used exactly as instructed, leads to so much death and destruction.
So you're saying actually tobacco should be treated the same as heroin, cocaine, cannabis, all those Class A drugs?
No, I actually have a very nuanced position on this because I'm a great believer that drug and substance policy you cannot follow a one size fits all approach. Heroin is a very particular case, and my own sense is that, and this is probably not the day or the forum to discuss this, we need to approach heroin addiction in a different fashion to recognize it as an absolute disease. Heroin addicts become gravely unwell if they have abrupt withdrawal from heroin or other appropriate opioid substitutes. And we need to find a way to actually regulate how heroin users get their opioid addiction and at the same time encourage them, strongly encourage them into some kind of rehabilitation effort. That would have the effect, I believe, of decreasing all of the associated harms that come with heroin, like crime, violence, personal health issues such as viral infections, hepatitis, etc. So it's a different issue. But for smoking, I really believe that while individuals may have a right to do what they want in the privacy of their own home, I don't believe that there is any God-given constitutional rights of man-based right to manufacture and to sell a product which specifically is designed to addict people to cancer-causing chemicals. I do not believe that such a right exists in commercial law. It's there because it grandfathered in from the time of the 16th century, and I believe we need to set a date and say this is it. After whatever, 2038, whatever, you will no longer be able to do this. So retool the factories, detox all those tobacco fields, start growing food instead. We have a huge population in the world. We have food shortages. Wouldn't it be much better to use all those fields for growing food rather than using it to grow tobacco? It'll take a while to detoxify the land because growing tobacco is bad for land. But that, it'll give the investment companies, the pension funds, it'll give them 10 years to divest, get out of this business, to tell the shops you'll no longer be able to sell it, to tell the factories you'll have to build something else.
John, while I have you on, there was a story yesterday which was covered on the station that that Australia has decided that vaping products could only be obtained further to a prescription, number one, and only available in a pharmacy on the basis that it's a therapeutic prescription to get you off the worse-er factor of tobacco and smoking. Essentially closing every vaping shop, looking at high levels of vaping amongst young people who never smoked. What's your take on the regulation of vaping? Because it started out as something that was an improvement, an aid to deal with smoking addiction.
I'm extremely supportive of that Australian initiative, and indeed all but the none but the very nerdiest scholars of Irish legislative history might know that Avril Power and I sponsored a bill to try and do something rather similar many years ago when we were both in Shannon-Aaron. I believe vaping is a powerful bridge for nicotine addicts to get off cigarettes and to get off smoking products. I believe it is also a dangerous access point for youngsters to become nicotine addicts, from which they may well, in many cases, graduate to actually smoking tobacco. So I think they should really just be used as a medicinal product to get people off off tobacco. And I'm sorry for all those people that have built livelihoods and livings out of you know, selling vaping products as commercial recreational products, but they shouldn't have done it. Society should not have allowed them to do it. Society should have warned them this is going in one direction. It is going in the direction of regulation. It is going in the direction of medicalization. And so I do think, again, the greater good here, there's a huge problem with kids vaping, a huge problem, and many of them, I believe, we will see reap a bitter harvest from this in years to come, and many of them become smokers.
And as a clinician, are there side effects from vaping that you're concerned about from a public health perspective?
Yes, Ivan, there are. But again, to put a perspective on this, the side effects of vaping are vastly less than the side effects of smoking. What I always advise my, in truth, dwindling number of smoking patients, if you need vaping to get off cigarettes, by all means, do it. But there are risks associated with it. There may well be cardiovascular risks. There is nicotine in it, which can cause constriction of blood vessels, abnormalities of the heart rate. It certainly can cause a number of different pulmonary lung conditions. So it's not a good thing to do. It's a bad thing to do. If it only existed as a recreational product, it would probably be appropriate to ban it completely. But I do believe it is a useful bridge for getting off smoking.
But is there an oncology risk, cancer risk from vaping?
Not really well documented. With vaping, there certainly are chemicals in it that are potentially carcinogenic. I'm not certain if epidemiological studies have as yet shown a real increase in cancer. And the problem, Ivan, is it's very hard to winkle out what the effect of vaping is in somebody who may have had a substantial smoking history beforehand. But there certainly are chemicals which are potential causes for concern in many vaping products.
Finally, in terms of oncology treatment, I chaired a conference, the Global Economic Summit, and they had these American health experts, and they said the big breakthrough in oncology treatment that we used to cut it out, burn it out, or poison it out with chemo, that the new development is to melt it out with immunology drugs. Is that the cusp of the new cancer breakthrough?
It's the most exciting development that we've seen in cancer treatment for possibly forever. It's extraordinary what has been achieved, and there's so many lessons in the immunotherapy story. The first one is humility in the face of nature, because for many years the oncology and cancer science community had it wrong about the immune system in cancer. The feeling was, well, our immune systems had been, you know, evolved in nature or designed by God, whatever you believe in, to give our bodies a defense against foreign invaders. Your immune system can recognize something that shouldn't be in your body, that is some foreign substance, i.e. a germ, and the immune system is very good for dealing with germs. And our sense was the reason the immune system didn't deal with cancer is that cancer is not a foreign invader. Cancer is our own cells, our own tissues, going rogue. And when they go rogue, they misbehave and they can become uncontrolled and can kill us. But the immune system, we thought, was not able to see a difference between those cells and normal cells. But we were very wrong. The immune system actually has a capacity for recognizing cancer as being something which is different, something which is alien, something which should not be there. And the reason the immune system doesn't eradicate cancer in nature, or in many cases does not eradicate cancer in nature, is there are natural brakes or restraints built into the immune system to stop it from going rogue. And these restraints are called checkpoints. And it was discovered that in one of those little accidents that nature makes, those checkpoints not only protected normal tissues from a rampant immune system, but they also protected cancer from the immune system. And the brilliant discovery, which led to two gentlemen winning the Nobel Prize about 7 or 8 years ago, was that you could inactivate these checkpoints, unleashing the power of the immune system and letting it get to work on cancer. And for some cancers, this has been utterly, utterly transformative. Melanoma, which sadly, tragically, is a cancer rapidly increasing in Ireland, has been hugely affected by this. In the old days, if you had melanoma which spread to other parts of your body, that was basically a death sentence. Only anecdotal individuals would survive. Now maybe 50 or 60% of patients are having long-term survival. Lung cancer, which is very relevant to our previous discussion, very big impact in lung cancer, and some wonderful research, much of it led by a brilliant young Irish oncologist in Baltimore called Patrick Ford, who will soon be coming back, I'm delighted to say coming back to work in Ireland, has shown that even for patients with earlier stage lung cancer where an operation is possible, but operations, though possible, frequently fail because many patients would still relapse with cancer. If you give those patients immune treatment before the operation, the results of the operation are dramatically better. So it's been phenomenal treatment.
It could be a complete game changer.
It has been, and it's moving quickly now. I think now gone past the first generation of studies. We've got a pretty good idea which cancers it helps, and sadly there are some cancers we're a bit stuck on. It doesn't do much for prostate. Sure. It doesn't do much for pancreas. We've discovered a few types of breast cancer where it does help, which we didn't know about until fairly recently.
Okay.
So it is becoming wider and wider. Good news.
Professor John Crown, one of our leading medical.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.